Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 6. Let's not ever forget that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skwepek people. I believe that doing what we can to resolve the situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, many listeners may well have heard the word emeritus, typically applied to an academic person who has moved into retirement. Well, this Latin word comes from the days of the Roman Empire. It was used to designate a soldier who had completed his 25 years of military service. He would be given land and a pension for life and treated with considerable honor and respect, probably because surviving 2.5 decades in the Roman army was no mean feat. Well, today our guest on Food Conversations is John Eichard, a distinguished professor emeritus and prolific writer and communicator who worked for 30 years in the world of academe before he retired 23 years ago from the University of Missouri, where he was a professor of agricultural economics. Fortunately, his survival was never as precarious as that of a Roman legionary, but John nevertheless faced challenges as he evolved into an active proponent of the new and expanding paradigm that is the focus of our show, the overall focus of our show, which is a shift back to sustainable, relocalized systems of growing food, systems that give back to nearby communities the wonderful gift of food sovereignty. John, a very warm welcome to Food Conversations.
Thank you. I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here with you today and to share some views with your listeners.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. But I might add, by the way, that retirement doesn't mean very much to many of us, including yourself, because since your retirement over a couple of decades ago, John, you've been a very busy man. Maybe you could share with our listeners what you do these days to help sustain the momentum of change in the agricultural world.
Well, as I get older, I'm doing less. But retirement to me was never about quit, just not doing anything. It was to give me an opportunity to do the things that I really wanted to do, without having to deal with kind of the bureaucracy of working within the framework of a public institution. So, whenever I retired, then that gave me the opportunity. And I, as you mentioned, I wrote books. I didn't have time to write books. I was doing other things when I was working in the university system, but once I retired, and then I could write about whatever I wanted to.
Which is another blessing.
Yeah, that was always a big thing with me. I always wanted to be able to decide for myself what I thought I ought to be doing for the good of the people. I always felt like I was working within the university system, public university system. My responsibility was to the people as a whole, not to the institution. So when I retired, that gave me the opportunity to do that. And I really pushed for the emeritus status. Emeritus status is not necessarily just given automatically. Your colleagues have to vote on it. And because my career was somewhat controversial on sustainable agriculture, there were some that probably would have just as soon not seen me get the emeritus title. But I kind of pushed through the administration and said, look, I've earned this because I wanted to continue to be able to function in a sense that it had an affiliation with the university.
Sure.
And the credibility of 30 years of academic experience behind what I was writing and what I was talking about.
And I think the world should be grateful for the fact that you did it, because it meant that you could speak as much from the heart as you wanted to, which I think is really important for all of us. The titles of your books really tell it all in terms of what you were trying to get across and still are. Here they are: The Essentials of Economic Sustainability, Crisis and Opportunities, Sustainability in American Agriculture. I love this one. Small farms are real farms, sustaining people through agriculture. And then a return to common sense. That sounds like something straight out of the Vales of Missouri. Sustainable capitalism, a matter of common sense. Sustainable capitalism, it's almost an oxymoron, but I think you make sense out of it. And the wonderful title, the title that I love the most is Revolution of the Middle and the Pursuit of Happiness.
Right.
John, if you never wrote another book, I think it's just, or even if just invented the title, it's such a lovely title. Now, I first heard about you through that wonderful journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development. And you wrote a column there, and it started in the, I think, the second issue of the very first edition. And you called yourself the economic pamphleteer. Now, pamphleteering is a noble tradition. John Milton was a famous pamphleteer, the author of Paradise Lost. And your first article was called Zoning Considerations for Urban and Peri-Urban Agriculture. Now, that sounds dry as dust, but it was very relevant to almost every community around the world, including the one I live in, called Salmon Arm, and British Columbia as a whole. And it focused on the problem of turning farmland into urban sprawl. And it reminded me of a song by Joni Mitchell, the Big Yellow Taxi, in which she says, "They paved paradise and put up a parking lot."
Right.
just comment, just that very early work you did for that journal, that must have given you a sense of liberty to speak out about important issues. And that one issue was a very important one.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciated the opportunity to write for the journal. They contacted me and asked me if I'd be willing to write a regular column for them. I called it the economic pamphleteer. Mine was patterned after Thomas Paine, who in the U.S. during Revolutionary War days was the pamphleteer. But anyway, so he was kind of a revolutionary, and that's what I thought. I started off in the early days of writing the column, focusing on, they would have themes for the overall journal. And I picked that peri-urban area to fit with the theme of that particular issue of the journal. But I always like to do that. I always like to be challenged to deal with a topic that maybe I didn't come up with independently, but someone said this is an important area, and then I was able to address it. And that's what I attempted to do there. And I wanted to make the point, you know, that even if urban areas maybe couldn't become totally self-sufficient, then they could become areas where you could produce enough food in the urban areas to give them a sense of like sovereignty, like they could survive without having to be hooked into the global food system and things of this nature. And I went back and kind of reviewed a bit of the history of it, and, you know, tried to make the case that maybe we couldn't return totally to the past, but that we had lessons from the past that we could learn to look to the future.
That's the, you know, this interface between the past and the present and the future, and the urban and the rural and the wild as well. These themes are constant themes on our show, but also very much themes in what you have written over the years.
Right.
And you go around doing presentations and speeches. Speeches where they say whatever you'd like to, John. We'd like to have you say what you want. You traveled quite a bit.
Yeah, I have traveled. The pandemic sort of really shut down on my travel to a great extent. But during the early years after I retired, I'd do 35, 40 speaking events a year. And even later on, until right up to the pandemic, I was doing 20, 25 speaking engagements a year where I'd be gone overnight, or at least I'd need to be reimbursed for expenses. And it was all where, you know, people would ask me to make a presentation on something, and it all fed upon itself. I told people, you know, one of the wonderful things about the internet is I would have gone off the map. Nobody would ever heard of me 3 or 4 years after I retired if the University of Missouri hadn't allowed faculty members to put up a website for each faculty member. And then I began to post papers of presentations and things. And so one speaking engagement led to another and to another. But I've been able to kind of continue the roving pamphleteer. I sometimes said I'm an itinerant economics teacher, I used to say.
Kind of like the minstrels in the Middle Ages. You went from town to town teaching people about the true depth of human experience. When you completed, we have a document called a guest profile that people complete before coming on the show.
Right.
And you ended your remarks with a quote from the famous economist John Maynard Keynes, describing his aspiration and yours to live wisely, agreeably, and well. Now, I think everyone listening to the show would share that aspiration, but Keynes also made another remark that I think is quite germane to everything we're talking about so far and will be talking about. And it's about farming. And it's amusing at one level, but it's also very much addresses the essence of growing food. Keynes said, "If farming were to be organized like the stock market, A farmer would sell his farm in the morning when it was raining, only to buy it back in the afternoon when the sun dried out, when the sun came out.
Yeah.
Now, I can't think of a better person than you, John, to explain why the essential nature of farming just does not fit with conventional capitalist economics.
I think the important part of that is it goes back to kind of what Keynes was talking about in the quote that you gave here and that I put in the application or the information I sent to you. When he was talking about learning to live wisely, agreeably, and well, he said, this is written in the early 1900s, 1920, somewhere along in there, and he said he thought within 100 years the economic problem would be solved. And he saw the economic problem was meeting the basic human needs of people, the basic material needs. Mm-hmm. And he says, once our basic material needs are met, then we can turn to the real important issues and the real important challenge of learning to live right, live wisely, you know, ethically, morally right with respect to taking care of the earth and each other, and agreeably getting along with each other, and well, still having enough to meet our basic needs.
Sure.
And I think what makes farming different, particularly sustainable farming, different than a business, is it has all of those dimensions. A true farm, a farming operation, is not just an economic enterprise. It is an economic enterprise in the sense that Keynes was talking about, that there are certain material needs you have to meet, and you certain have to have a certain income and this sort of thing, because you can't do everything on the farm, so you got to buy something. So it has to be economically viable. But it also has to be ecologically sound. You have to take care of the land, because you're coming back, and the land is what supports long-run productivity. And then you need to be a good neighbor, and you need to be a place where families can come together. And if you don't do all of those things, if you simply focus on one of them, which is what capitalism is about, it's purely economics, then if you don't do the social and the ecological, you can't sustain the farming operations. Independent family farmers have known this for centuries, but we've forgotten it in the last 50 or 60 years.
I would add to what you said and say that probably our species has known this for many thousands of years.
Yeah.
But we have in the last 150 years in particular, but certainly in the last couple of hundred, 300, 400 years, we've just progressively got away from that awareness, right. And it's leading us to all sorts of difficulties. Just remind listeners that I'm speaking today with John Eichert, who's a professor emeritus of agriculture and applied economics from the University of Missouri. Now, John, in addition to having the capacity to give such a fluid explanation of what agriculture and growing food is all about, you, in your work in the world of academe, had almost two separate careers. I mean, they weren't really separate. They were, of course, intimately tied together, but they were two foci, two directions that you moved in.
Yep.
You started out as a conventional agricultural economist, as you describe it, a proponent for industrial agriculture, and then perforce, things changed. You saw things differently and realized that there was this new dimension that you needed to bring forward. And that was the second career involved with advocating, as through your books, for example, for sustainable agriculture. Those words occur repeatedly, sustainable agriculture, economics, etc., in all those titles. John Maynard Keynes had another quote that I think would stimulate our thoughts a little bit. He was speaking to someone who was questioning his approach to economics, which is now widely recognized as sound, but at the time he had his critics. And Keynes said to this interlocutor, he said, "When my information changes, I alter my conclusions. What do you do, sir?" And I can imagine the person he was speaking to going a little red in the face. Why didn't you talk about that and transition in your sort of intellectual and social and personal environment that took place that led you, as some in the old conventional world would say, astray? What was that like?
Yeah. Well, I think the Keynes quote's very appropriate for what led me to my transition. Because
you can put it over your desk at home.
Yeah. I started off, you know, as I said, as a very conventional agricultural economist. It was the idea that farming had to be a bottom line business. We had to, you know, to the extent it was a family farm, you couldn't let the family business get in the way of the farm, because the farm had to earn the money to support the family and things of this nature. And so specialize, standardize, consolidate, get larger, become more efficient, reduce the cost of production, increase opportunities for profitability for the innovative farmer, for the progressive farmer. And at the same time, since we'd have profitable farms, then we were going to have viable rural communities. We'd have prosperous rural communities because we improved the efficiency of agriculture. And it was going to be good for everybody. It was going to be good for society because we'd bring down the cost of food by bringing down the cost of production and so on. And that's what I bought into, and I think that's what most economists believed at that time. But as we went through the years then, I began to realize that as we specialized, standardized, consolidate, the farms had to get larger because we're increasing production faster than consumer demand was increasing. So that meant some farmers had to fail so that others could succeed. And so that was the beginning then of me seeing the fault. This was not good for farmers. So I could tell that, and I said, okay, that, I didn't get into it for this particular reason. So
yes. You did understand what small farms are all about because you grew up in a small dairy farm in southwestern Missouri. The middle child of five, which I think is always the point where you have to communicate with the older ones and the right. younger ones and somehow make sure that you keep your place. Talk a little bit about that farm. Your dad had been very much affected by the Depression. He and two of his brothers started it up, and then he took off. Just describe that process, because it was very important for you.
Yes. He grew up on a, he was on a small farm, and then his dad died when he was in the fourth grade, and he had to leave school and go to work. And so he went to work, but he and his two brothers together, I don't know how they did it when he was the oldest one that was out working, but I don't know how they did it. But the time they got in their 20s, then they were able to buy a farm during the midst of the Great Depression. And they ended up being able to work that farm and pay for that farm. And what my dad's success, you know, on the farm, and then my mother was a major contribution. She worked, you talk of sun up to sundown. Mm. They both worked sun up to sundown. But growing up on the farm, I could understand that as a way of life. And within a farming community where a farmer couldn't run a farm by themselves, they had to depend upon the neighbors, the crew for filling silos and the crew for harvesting and threshing and things of that
raising
nature.
A barn.
So it was the whole community, you know, had to work together. We had a barn that burned down, and the whole neighbors come in and helped us rebuild the barn. So I could see, you know, what independent family farming was really about and the quality of life that was there regardless of the economic consequences.
Do you remember, John, looking back, the kind of atmosphere when adversity would, like when the barn burned down, the sense that everybody had of kind of cooperative, collaborative outcomes? Do you have a feeling for that?
Yes, that's what they had back then. I sometimes refer to it when we talk about recreating communities, you know, food sovereign communities. Is what we had before were kind of communities of necessity. People had to do that. That was the only way you could make it. The only way you could farm and make a living would be to work together with each other. And then as we increased our economic affluence, then we began to think, okay, we can buy and sell things. We don't really need communities. And we've kind of lost our sense of value of the communities. But I argue now we're back in a time where we're facing the need for communities of necessity again, because just like I was saying, that agriculture system is talking about working or not working, that the economy that's built up on that pursuit of economic self-interest and increasing efficiency and productivity, that's not working either. And in order to, you know, survive now, we're going to have to rebuild communities. And those are communities of necessity, different from before, but
yes,
still a lot of the same characteristics.
Well, now we're realizing, we're recognizing that Mother Nature is actually trying to teach us a few lessons. And instead of it being face-to-face with Mother Nature, we're able to have the concept, like it's a self-conscious process now, as opposed to just what you have to do. It's becoming more communicable because it's defined, it's clear. We're not just playing at this game. We're actually on a planet with finite resources. And if we ignore that, we're in big trouble. Now, I want to just give you a phrase that you can respond to. How does a hog become a mortgage lifter?
Well, we called him the mortgage lifter back then because, that's to say, when I was growing up on a farm, in my early years, we always had a farm payment that would come due in the fall because that was the harvest season. So that's when you had to make the payment on the farm if you were going to keep it. And so many people had lost their farms during the Great Depression. There was always that fear that you could lose it. And so what you'd have then, the hogs, you'd have hogs on the farm, and then they would be farrowing in the spring, you know, so when the weather got better and this sort of thing, and you'd have the pigs growing through all summer. And then by fall, they would be ready to go to market. And so you'd have the pigs that you fed through the year, and you'd feed them garbage, and you'd feed them shorts, you'd feed them whatever.
They're like
whatever
us, they'll eat anything.
Yeah, you'd feed them anything you could get them to eat. And then in the fall, you would have hogs, and then, you know, whether or not, I always said we sold the hogs to make the payment on the farm, and if there were any hogs left after that, then we had something to eat during the winter. Otherwise, we were back to hunting and fishing during the winter in order to have protein.
I'd remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with John Eichard, the Professor Emeritus of Agricultural and Applied Economics from the University of Missouri. John, you refer to the fact that your mother and I presume your father worked from dawn to dusk. It was a model of a work ethic of application to what had to be done. Now, John Maynard Keynes mentioned to agreeable. Your father must have been an agreeable, hardworking person as well.
Right. And one thing that made the work you know, more acceptable or endurable or whatever, is that they weren't by themselves. It was the family, you know, of kids, five kids working on, we all had things to do on the farm. And so the farm work was family life, and raising, part of farming was raising kids as well. You know, it was all part of the same thing. And then it was within the community, because the people would get together for a lot of these chores. And I think my dad really looked forward to the fall when he could come in and you'd have the silo crew of 30 or 40 men that would come in and cut down the corn with knives and that sort of thing. A big gathering of the whole community. Mm-hmm. And then the farm wives would come together, and there'd be a whole lot of other women come in and help my mother prepare the meals for the families. And we'd go through three or four different tables where the people would come in.
Long trestle tables.
Yeah, and you'd go from one farm to another, and then putting up hay in the summertime back when we had horses and riding horses and all that. So it was this way of life. The work was intermingled with this family way of life, this community way of life. So it was all part of the same thing.
You know, it's such a powerfully beneficial way to live that in the world of industrial agriculture these days, you see trucks drive by that, you know, come from some major corporate distributor of food. And they always have, not always, but they often have a picture of the family farm, which is so threatened and has been so threatened, although there is a resurgence beginning. But they know that that touches the hearts of so many people. That was the way of life for so many people. Right. And it's emotionally so deeply satisfying. It's so different from the go to the store and buy something in a plastic package kind of thing. Right.
Yeah, they're selling this idea of the positive legacy of independent family farms that has built up over generations, over decades. I'm not saying everything was perfect about those independent family farms. And you talk about, you know, they were farming in indigenous land they didn't take it away from people, but it was taken away from the indigenous people and things of that nature. But they had built up over time kind of this reputation of being concerned about their neighbors, being concerned about the land, being concerned about their animals. Just you know, Thomas Jefferson referred to the yeoman farmer as having the independence and virtue and thoughtfulness of mind that was essential for democracy. And so it was all built on that. So they're taking that image, but the only place the family farm exists still today is in this new sustainable agriculture, local food movement. And then also in the U.S. anyway, of the farm families, overall, farm families get about 85, 90% of their income comes from something other than farming. So indeed, most of the people that are out here on farms today are still living on the farm because they like that way of life of being out in the open air and being around space in the countryside. Right. But they're really supporting the farm with an off-farm income. So even the families we have left aren't being supported by the farms that are there.
Absolutely. And the stats for Canada are the same as they are for the United States. And interesting, those stats don't apply when you get beyond North America and especially beyond Europe and North America and get into other continents. You mentioned this when we were talking before, that outside these industrial agricultural centers, sustainable agriculture and family farms are still very much the rule in many parts of the world.
Right.
This seemed to start, as I recall, in the 70s, and it kind of crystallized in the early 80s. That's when Earl Butz, who was at the time the U.S. Right. Secretary of the Interior, started to advocate for basically cheap food for everybody.
Right.
And the missing part of that was food quality, but the goal, and at the time it was probably conceived to be a laudable goal, was to make sure everybody had enough food on the table. It didn't right. matter whether the food was as good for them as it yeah. should be, but at least they had the food there. And that was starting to cause harm. You saw bankruptcies. You saw farmer suicides. You, as an agricultural economist, saw these communities starting to die. They were starting to shrivel up and die. That must have been hard to watch.
Well, it was, you know, and back to our earlier conversation about changing your mind. When you get new information, then you change your mind. It was hard to watch. I'd spent my whole academic career, you know, everything I'd been taught, undergraduate, graduate school, and after that was that this was going to be good for societies, good for farmers, good for rural communities. But new information was that it wasn't. It wasn't working out the way that we thought it was going to. So I had to change my whole career in the mid career. You know, I had built a career in one area, and now I saw I no longer believe in the economics I was taught and the economics I was teaching. I just couldn't continue to do it.
Now, the stated goal of this switch from family farms to broad globalization of the food supply was, I suppose, and I'm sure this statistic was touted, and that was that the percentage cost of food for a family's income dropped from about 18% to about 9%. It dropped by half. And I suspect that was the brick wall that, considering sustainable agriculture and family farms, crashed against. People would be saying, well, it's food's cheaper, you know, don't have to spend too much money on food.
Right.
But you, so there was kind of a tempestuous atmosphere, I'm sure, in the not just in the agricultural academic community, but also in the field. This focus on quantity versus quality. When you started to talk about quality, about truly including the family farm in the mix of agricultural enterprises, it generated some pushback. What kind of things started to happen?
Well, I think within the university system and within what I call the agricultural establishment, USDA and Grant universities, agricultural colleges,
yes.
You know, the whole range of even rural chambers of commerce and things like this is the idea that, you know, that agriculture is really good. And why would you question the food system? We've got the widest variety of the safest and most healthful food in the world at the lowest possible cost to consumers and that sort of thing. So why would you question that? But I think during the 1990s, there were already signs that you could point to where there's real statistics there, that we had a growing epidemic of obesity and diabetes and high blood pressure
Indeed.
And heart disease and various other things that were associated with the American diet. So we saw that. And then the other part of it, even though the average cost of food for the average consumer as a percent of income was going down, we weren't getting good food to the people at the lower income levels. The percentage of people that are classified as hungry or food insecure hadn't gone down at all. In fact, we had a higher rate of people classified as food insecure in the early 2000s and still have today than we had back in the late 1960s.
Yes.
And the thing was, is that we, when we went to relying on the market to provide overall food security, the market doesn't respond to need. The market responds to the ability and willingness to pay. And the problem with most people who are hungry and malnourished and people that are eating too much junk food is because they're in a position where they simply can't afford to pay for the good food, or don't know, you know, what, where to buy it, or how to afford it.
And this is where the notion of the externalization of costs comes in. It comes in many sectors of modern, what we call modern society, but it's certainly in food. It's, well, we don't care if you get sick from eating our highly processed food. You're paying for it, and you've therefore accomplished the only task that we consider relevant. That's sort of what the animus was, the animating feature behind that. Now, right in the middle of this, or around this time, in 1987, the Brundtland Report came out, and it formulated what had been burbling around for a century or two, this notion of sustainability. Did that give impetus to you or to the agricultural community, some members of it anyway?
Well, I think it did. With me, it was kind of after the fact. When I got involved in sustainable agriculture because of my concerns about agriculture, then I began to delve into this whole concept of sustainability, economic sustainability and the whole thing. And then that's when I came across sort of the Brundtland Report. But it really fit in with kind of the concept that I was developing with sustainable agriculture, which I'm sure came from people that had read the Brundtland Report and had bought into that. I just hadn't heard of it yet. Mm. But when I went back to University of Missouri to lead up on sustainable agriculture work in that area, it fit in with what University of Missouri had in the early 1900s called balanced farming. And balanced farming was about, you know, meeting the needs of families as economically, but also taking care of the land, soil conservation. It was about family life, bringing electricity and running water and things to rural communities. And so when we talked about the Brundtland Report meeting the needs of the present, you know, you need the needs, but do it in a way that preserves opportunities for the future. And the ecological, social, economic was basically sustainable agriculture. It was balanced farming. It was so it all fit together and it made sense to me. And I remember thinking at that time I'd switched around during my career from one subject to another. And then I thought when I got into sustainable agriculture, this question is big enough. It'll last me the rest of my life. And it has.
That's a wonderful feeling to have. You know, it's sort of like finding your métier, you know, what you can do that ties the experiences you had when you were very young to the experiences you were having then and your experiences that you imagine in the future. You didn't just do this in a theoretical academic sense. Funding started to come out for sustainable agriculture in the late 80s. There was a beginning of that sort of process. And you were involved with an interesting university, Lincoln University, which had originally been a black university for farmers who couldn't get into the white universities. And then, of course, with integration, a few white students were allowed into Lincoln University. But talk about listening sessions. It sounds so normal, but it was kind of an innovation at the time. What were your listening sessions all about?
Well, the listening sessions, when I got to the University of Missouri and they found out I was serious about sustainable agriculture, that we were really going to deal with it, not just pretend everything we were doing was sustainable. That's what they thought I was going to do, is
you were a
figure
fake.
Out how to sell everything we were doing. Is
they didn't know that you were from Missouri. You couldn't do it.
So when we began to get the pushback, then I formed an alliance. I knew that they had a small farms program at Lincoln University, which was, you know, 25 miles from where I was on the campus there. And so I connected with the leader of the program down there, a fellow by the name of Dal Ramswell March, and we kind of integrated the small farms program with the sustainable agriculture program. So we had between Lincoln University and University of Missouri. And so we were still getting pushback, but we said, okay, we're doing what we think that people of the state of Missouri really want done. And there's nothing wrong with supporting doing things for the big farmers, but there's a lot of small farmers out here that want something different. And so what we proposed then is saying, okay, if, if you don't like what we're doing, let's go out and see what the people really want. So we had listening sessions where Dalrymple Marsh and I would go around, and there's other people that went with us, and then we would have the county extension people invite in people, particularly small farmers and people interested in alternative agriculture. And we'd say, what kind of things do you want us to do that the University of Missouri is not doing or Lincoln University is not doing? And so we just asked the people what we wanted them to do for
us. What a novel concept, John, asking people what they want as opposed to telling them what they want. Right. And you made notes, which is more important. You made notes of what they said and brought that back to the sort of intellectual ferment that was going on in universities.
Yeah, and this was another lesson that I learned on is people work harder and more committed when they're working on something that they individually believe in. So we had recruited a group of people from both of our organizations to work with us. And after the listening sessions, we come back and said, okay, here are the major things that the people said that they would like to have. Now, who within the group is willing to take leadership for that? And we'll try to find you funding and we'll give you support. But we need somebody out of this group because we don't have enough resources to do it from here. And so it's involving the people, you know, that we're really out here and we're really committed to these causes was what made the program much more effective than it had been if we'd have been trying to direct everything from the top.
And you did an interesting thing. You didn't say no flat out to industrial agriculture and CAFOs, concentrated animal feed operations, the factory farms that people know about today are starting to realize are a problem. What you did was you said, we want to build up these individual farmers alongside the CAFO system. Okay, you can have your CAFOs if you like, but have your CAFOs and eat them. but you could also develop this return and resurgence of family farms. And you called it guerrilla warfare. Come with a little bit of like nonviolent, I might add, for listeners' benefit, nonviolent guerrilla warfare. What was that like? Yeah.
Well, what I was really talking about here is that when we continue to get the pushback, and part of the listening sessions with this as well, that we build a constituency of people that we, you know, I call it a constituency because I think if you're in public service, the people aren't your customers. They're your constituents, and people aren't working with you. You know, they're collaborators and this sort of thing. And so that's what we did. And then we, our constituents then, like through the listening sessions, our constituents then would say, this is what we want from our university. And we would say, it's fine that you have the industrial agriculture people coming into the dean's office and sitting down and saying, this is what we want from the university. But we said, we've got a group of people also that are saying, this is what we want from the university. And I kept reminding people, and I still do that. I said, okay, if you're in the private sector, if you go into a Walmart store, for example, and you have $10 and I got one, then you get to buy 10 times as much stuff. But if we go into a voting booth and you have $10 and I've got one, we still have one vote. And I said, going into a university, a public institution, is like going into a voting booth. It's not like going into a Walmart store. It doesn't matter how much money the person has that comes and asks you to help them. It's each person needs to be respected and has the same inherent worth as anybody else that comes here.
I was just thinking of the notion of when you're hungry, you need food, but you don't need more food than you can eat. You need enough food to be healthy and survive. And that heads directly into the whole notion of relocalizing, recentering the food production system in the communities where the food is consumed. And we're going to talk more about that in a moment. In the middle of all this, On a grander scale, there was, of course, the Rio Conference, the officially called the UN Conference on Environment and Development, and it also helped to propel some of these ideas forward. There was a conference, a biodiversity conference and rule that was established, and it's interesting. David Suzuki's daughter, Severn Cullis Suzuki, was a 12-year-old at the time, and she made a speech at this conference, which is widely recorded, and it sort of presages Greta Thunberg, who has become a well-known personality and spokesperson for positive change. When you saw this coming out and this information about chronic disease being associated, and by whether the evidence now is very strong. It's you take people who eat a lot of highly processed foods, and they have more health issues than people who eat fresh, local, especially organic food. This was all going around, but you paid a certain price for being an exponent of the new model, the new paradigm. Right. Things like appointments just didn't happen. Things just sort of went away. And you had your own little academic defense system that you employed to keep right. things going. Talk about that a little bit, John.
Well, the one thing I discovered is I went to the University of Missouri on a grant that I got from USDA out of the first sustainable agriculture money there. But I learned if you bring your own money into the university, they'll pretty much let you do things they wouldn't let you do otherwise. So we built our program on sustainable agriculture program at the University of Missouri. It was all built on contracts and grants and this sort of thing. I also learned if you get a grant and you do a really good job of what the people really want done rather than just what you want to do and don't worry about them, then you can get another grant. And so yeah. that's the way we kept that program going. But another thing that I did that I think ties in directly with what you're talking about in terms of nutrition, I went back to, there was a noted professor at the University of Missouri in soil science called William Albrecht back in the early 30s and 40s, and he was highly respected, and he really resisted sort of the industrialization of agriculture. And I'll keep this real short, but he says, once you go to just focusing on productivity, he called it NP and K, just the fertilizer rather than building the soil fertility. But he says, once you allow economics to drive the system, you're going to end up with maximizing production. And he says, you will end up with foods that are high in calories, which he called go foods, but are lacking in the essential nutrients that are required for good human health.
The micronutrients.
You're going to end up with a sick population. And right before I left, before I retired, they asked me to do the Albrecht lecture, and I went back through this. But we had historical, we could go back, you know, to earlier times, and we had really highly respected scientists out of that period of time that we could quote from and that we could use prior to the foundation for saying, okay, we've got some real problems here, and these people anticipated it. We ought to recognize and admit it.
Some of the pushback was against this new model, which listeners, we're talking about that something's coming on strong now, but at the time there was all sorts of resistance that was really, really challenging. Talk about food disparagement laws. That's right. One tool that was used to push back against this change.
Yeah, the food disparagement laws, I can't remember exactly when, but I think it was during the 90s. Most people in the U.S. anyway, we remember the Oprah Winfrey case where Oprah Winfrey
said
had someone
rude
on
about
her
beef in
yeah
Texas.
Her program. Well, she had someone that was talking about mad cow disease, and she made the remark, "I'll never eat another hamburger" or something after that. But anyway, so the Cattlemen's Association and some others sued her, but they come up then, and the state started passing laws. I've lost track of how many there are, maybe a dozen or so. Mainly these are in agricultural states. And they passed laws that said, okay, if you write or say anything that's disparaging about the food system, then you're subject to be sued. And then you have to prove that what you said, like if you're in an academic community, then you're subject to having all of your data and all of your analysis brought into court and examined by other experts, so to speak, to determine whether or not your conclusions were credible and whether or not your justification is just academic justification or, you know, logical justification for the remarks that you made. Well, even if you got the most credible of scientific information, the most logical of reasoning that led to your conclusion, you still face this prospect of being drug into court and having to hire a lawyer and legal fees and, you know, the strung out process of having to discovery. You have to bring in your computer and all your information, all your data. So it was really a chilling effect within the university system on people that would, you know, challenge the existing, I call it the agricultural establishment and the status quo of industrial agriculture. There were several other things going on, but I think this was one in the academic community that had a major effect.
Just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with John Eichert, who's Professor Emeritus of Agriculture and Applied Economics from the University of Missouri. And as you can hear from our discussion, somebody who's I would call you, John, a faithful witness to this process that was leading West, so-called developed countries, developed civilizations, away from their roots. And you were one of the people who saw that happening, but also played an active role. You weren't just a witness watching, you were actually a participant. And being able to participate actively in pushing back against the pushback, if you like, to some extent arose from the fact that you had paid your dues and done your work in the academic community. You had some stature and recognition. And you also had people who were in that world who, not necessarily openly, but at a personal level, supported you. You told me that the provost at University of Missouri was a fellow agricultural economist, right, and he actually grew up close to where you had grown up.
Yeah. You know, I think during that period of time that what was really helpful. You know, that there were some people that were supportive and understood what we were doing. And even though that we were pushing in one direction, they would have people behind the scenes that would be willing to support us. And the particular instance that you're talking about later on has become more and more difficult within the universities. They still had people that understood this whole idea of academic freedom. And there was really two different people that really supported me in the later years. One was a fellow agricultural economist. And you talked about me having a career beforehand. Not only had I been a department head at the Extension Agricultural Economics Department at the University of Missouri, but I'd been elected vice president, then president of the Southern Agricultural Economics Association. I'd chaired the Extension Committee of the American Agricultural Economics Association. And Brady Deaton, who was the provost of Missouri, had been involved in all of those things. And so he was very well aware of my past career. So whenever I got in a bind, I'd start writing memos and emails, and then I'd copy Brady Deaton so he knew what was going on. And then the other was a fellow by the name of Ron Turner, who ended up being vice president for Extension, executive vice president at the overall Extension organization. And he'd grown up in the same small town that I grew up in, and he was, you know, his dad was a cattle trader. He'd come around with his pickup truck and buy a few calves from us and take them to the auction market in Springfield and things like this. So he'd come out of the same background I had the same leanings I had. So it was those people that we could go to. And there was still the concept of academic freedom that you could lean back on. And I had to do that 2 or 3 years ago when somebody wanted to take the papers that I had posted on my University of Missouri website. They wanted the department head to take them off, and I come back and reminded him of the articles of the American Association of University Professors, where it talks about academic freedom, and it says that the responsibility of the faculty member is to the public, to serve the public good, not to serve the institution. And when there's a conflict between serving the public and serving the institution, you have an academic responsibility to serve the public. So I never heard back from him after that.
That's always a good sign if your interlocutor goes silent. I think we've got about 10 more minutes, but I'd like to talk a little bit about solutions and the changes, because what we've talked about so far is this tumultuous transformation that began in the 70s and 80s and then became more firmly established in the 90s and the first years of the 2000s. And now we can have a show like this called Food Conversations, talking about food sovereignty, and people aren't scratching their heads and saying, what is this all about? They're saying that, yes, and a lot of guests on our show are saying, yes, that's exactly what we're aiming for. So why don't we talk about the notion of a community food utility, because you've emphasized this as a good place to focus these energies, these new energies.
Yes, I think, you know, a real problem with relying on markets, as I said before, markets respond to ability to pay. They don't respond to basic need. And that's so that we have a hunger issue. I talk about hunger as being a market failure. Economists refer to market failure. They say, okay, it's something that's good for the public interest that markets fail to do. So we recognize it as a market failure, and that's the reason we have government food assistance programs, is because the idea of feeding the people, providing food security through relying on markets, just simply didn't work, and so we had to increase government food assistance. But now the government food assistance programs have become about as bureaucratic and impersonal as the markets are. They respond to the rules and regulations within the bureaucracy, and if that doesn't fit the need of the particular people, and still they give in to the market. They give people money, and the food companies convince them to spend the money on junk food, or they don't give them an opportunity to have access to good food, and so they're left out without. And so I've said, okay, it's a market failure, and the current programs to address the market failure aren't working. So here's another alternative. We can have public utilities. We use public utilities for sewer and water and electricity and a whole range of things, where it makes sense then for the community as a whole to make sure that everybody has access to this service, as opposed to just leaving it totally to the market to decide whether or not you have it. And most people think of public utilities as a monopoly, but it's basically appropriate for any place where you have a market failure. And so I've said, okay, let's establish a community food utility, and within this community, let's give this community a monopoly on ensuring that everybody in that community has good, wholesome, nutritious food.
Yes, and that sort of diversity, which is community-based because each community is a little different and each set of growing circumstances is quite different. That notion of localizing this, of making it part of a land base that is attached or surrounds a community, is a key concept, is it not?
It is, and it's the connectedness. It's the thing that makes the local community so important is the connection to the land, but it's also the connection of the people to each other. It has to be a sense of personal connectedness to each other to ensure that everybody has good food, but it has to be a sense of personal connectedness to the land to ensure that the land is used in a way that doesn't degrade or destroy its productivity, that can sustain good health. And so the local community is essential to reestablish the connectedness among people and people with the earth.
And it also allows an easier process of getting local ideas to come forward, of having people who live in the community say, well, this can work in our community. I know because I've done it, or I know because, you know, the evidence is there. That's a key thing, bringing local voices to the fore. This is right back to your listening sessions in the 1980s. It's institutionalizing listening sessions, making them a feature. I don't want to use the word institution too much, but it is sort of making it a formal commitment.
Right. Rather than standardizing everything, which is what we've done in industrialization to make it efficient, what we're doing is recognizing people are different, lands are different, and we have to tailor whatever we need, providing services have to fit the particular people in a particular place.
John, what do you see as, you know, we've talked about this transition, which is now underway. I think it's clearly underway. What, when you look at what's happening more broadly, do you feel hopeful, cautiously optimistic, a little bit pessimistic? That's, I think, a Missouri trait, but nonetheless willing to keep going at it. How does that play out in your thoughts and feelings?
Well, my standard answer is that I'm not necessarily optimistic, but I'm hopeful. Now, hope doesn't mean that you know that something is going to work. It doesn't mean that it's going to be quick and easy, but hope is based on the knowledge that something is possible. So when I see these farmers out here that are, you know, farming sustainably, and they're finding a way to make a living, mainly by connecting with customers who care about what they're doing, I see the local food hubs, and I see the growth in farmers markets, and I see the growth in, you know, the community supported agriculture and the food sovereignty movement. And, you know, the sustainable agriculture movement didn't revolutionize agriculture in 15 or 20 years as we hoped it did, but it's still there and it's still going live and well. Now you see it in regenerative agriculture. Everybody's concerned, interested in solving climate change. All of these things prove to me that it's possible to make the transition, and there's increasing research that it's possible that we can make the transition, and we can do it in a way that's affordable, that make good food accessible. And in that possibility, there's hope. And so I'm hopeful. It's going to be up to the people, you know, to take advantage of the opportunities that are there, and then I keep hoping that at some point, as this movement continues to grow, and I think it's far larger than anybody believes because it's so fragmented, it's so diverse, it doesn't fit the model of a movement. But I'm convinced that at some point we could reach that tipping point, and then we'll see a great transformation. One of the things about being old, as you said before, I lived through the transition, and basically we transformed that independent family farm local food system into the industrial global food system within a period of 40 to 50 years, and we can change it back just as quick or quickly.
John, I refer to you as a faithful witness of the transformation that has now become a necessity, transformation to an approach to growing food that is in tune with the rhythms and the energies of the planet we live on. And you're not only that, in my opinion, but also an eloquent and fluent communicator of these ideas. And it's no surprise that the journal that you had a column in asked you to do the column, because they knew that you had a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of direct experience addressing the transformation that is now upon us, that we have to apply ourselves to. I really do want to thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
And at some point, I would love to get in touch with you again and get your opinion on some of the events that unfold in the future, because there will be a future, and they will unfold. Thank you very much for joining us from far away across the 49th parallel and sharing your thoughts with us. I know they were very much appreciated by our listeners.
Thank you for this opportunity.